Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 95.
Tangmong gets to this palace, and the details, they just surround you. You've got ucha drum music filling the sky, the source says.
Loud, yeah.
And yeah, this amazing exotic smell everywhere. And then the maids, they look like angels, basically.
Uh-huh. The descriptions are really something.
They use these classical comparisons. Graceful, jade-like skin, icy muscles, it sounds almost cold, but beautiful.
Right. And more charming than the women of Chu, more beautiful than Shishi, the famous beauty. It's not just saying they're pretty.
No, it's signaling something, isn't it? This otherworldly, almost dangerous beauty designed to trap you.
Definitely. But Tangmong, he's the constant pilgrim, isn't he? He stays humble through it all. Bows his head, doesn't dare look up.
And that's not just him being polite, is it? Mm. It really shows how strong his focus is, his spiritual path, even with all this temptation.
It's his discipline, yeah. Really powerful.
But our main man, Sun Wukong, he's not buying it for a second.
Not at all. He's hiding, right? Invisibly perched on Tangmong's hat, though.
His Varakana hat, yeah. And he uses those famous eyes, the fiery goldy eyes, and spots something.
A demonic aura, a herby on the princess. It's faint. The text says, Jidi She, like just a hint. Not super evil looking, but...
But enough for Wukong. His insight cuts through it. What does that say about deception in these stories, that just a little trace is all you need?
I think it shows that real perception, true seeing, is about picking up on the subtleties, not the big flashy stuff.
Hmm.
And what's cool is Wukong actually admires Tangmong in that moment. He thinks to himself, Kyu Jusho.
Good monk. In splendor, but no desire. Walking on jade, but not lost.
Yeah. It's like even Wukong, the troublemaker, respects his master's purity right then.
He doesn't hang about with the warning, though. Whispers urgently, Master, the princess is fake.
Simple and direct.
But Tangmong hesitates. He doesn't want to freak out the king, basically. He wants to wait till court is over. Do you think that's like a weakness? Or just him sticking to the rules, even when there's danger?
Oh, it's definitely part of his character. Not a flaw, I'd say. He's all about patience, propriety, doing things the right way, which often clashes with Wukong.
Who's the total opposite.
Exactly. Wukong is impatient. He can't wait. He just ignores the master's caution.
And bam, with this massive roar, Wukong drops the invisibility, reveals his true self, scares everyone half to death.
Right, and he goes straight for the princess. Grabs her.
And lays into her with this incredible accusation. Calls her a beast. Says she's making fake things real.
Still wants to trick my master, break his true yang, fulfill your lust.
And that true yang isn't just about, you know, celibacy. In Taoist terms, it's his pure life force, right? Key for his spiritual journey.
Precisely. So the demon wants to absorb that energy. It's a spiritual attack, not just lust.
The scene just dissolves into chaos after that. King's stunned, queens falling over, maids running for cover. Nobody not hiding somewhere.
Pandemonium. The beauty from moments before. Gone. Utterly shattered.
And there's this amazing poetic bit describing the chaos, comparing it to itchative. Spring wind blowing, autumn air swirling, like fallen flower petals covering the ground.
It's beautiful imagery. But it's about destruction, isn't it? The ruin of that illusion. Very effective.
So the demon's exposed. She struggles free, rips off her clothes, her jewelry. The disguise literally falling apart, revealing the monster underneath.
And then she grabs a weapon. But it's weirdly ordinary. A short club that looks like a pestle from some little shrine in the garden.
Yeah, not what you'd expect from a powerful demon. Very odd choice.
So the fight kicks off. Wukong's Grog, his famous golden cudgel, against the demon Sia, the pestle club. One is Utna, famous, the other Utno known. Nice contrast there.
Sets up the power dynamic, or what seems like it.
And the text is super clear about why they're fighting. Wukong's there, Utnya for the scriptures, protecting the mission.
Standard hero stuff, but the demon.
Two reasons. One, she came, Huyan. She loved the rare flowers there. But the main goal, Yuya, to combine with Tangmong's essence.
Targeted. Not random at all. She's after that spiritual power.
And then we get this chilling little detail. She had Sino In captured the real princess last year.
Whoa. So this isn't new. She's been playing this part for a whole year.
Exactly. Shows how patient and cunning she is.
Meanwhile, back on the ground, everyone's terrified. The whole city, the officials.
Understandably.
But Tang Monk, even though he hesitated before, now he steps up, calms the king down, assures him Wukong is just using magic to sort out true from false.
And the court ladies see the discarded clothes.
Ah, right. The evidence.
And they finally get it. Okay, this wasn't our princess. Relief, maybe, but understanding, at least.
But the fight's nowhere near done. It goes up into the sky, lasts for ages. Udong, half a day, no winner.
Neck and neck. So Wukong pulls out a trick.
The multiplication thing. His rod becomes hotopo. One becomes 10, 10, 100, 100, 1,000.
Described like Yuperu, snakes and pythons writhing. Imagine that. A sky full of swirling golden rods.
Overwhelms the demon clearly. She makes a break for it. Transforms into a two, a clear breeze, and heads for the West Heaven Gate.
Sneaky escape. But Wukong's right on her tail. He even calls in backup. The heavenly guards tells them to block her way.
Cornered. And this is where she spills the beans about her weapon. That humble-looking pestle, the...
And get this, it's anything but humble. It's material. An immortal root of mutton fat jade.
Wow, that's like top-tier material in Chinese culture, right? Pure value.
Absolutely. And its age, shaped over countless years. It existed before the universe as we know it, since true, when chaos opened, when primal chaos split apart.
Okay, hold on. So this isn't just an old club, it's primordial.
Pretty much. It elevates the whole conflict, doesn't it? This isn't just some random demon fight anymore.
No kidding. And it's from heaven, born to you, imbued with chul, golden light, four phenomena, and the auspicious energy of the five elements and three origins.
And it lived in the Shrip, the Toad Palace, and the Ah, the Osmanthus Palace.
Both names for the moon palace.
Exactly. This is a divine pestle from the moon.
Mind blown. So why did it come down to Earth?
Two reasons again. It came down because it loved flowers,
Yeah.
and it wanted to marry Tang Monk to fulfill some kind of old predestined relationship. Karma, maybe?
Suyin. Predestined connection. That makes her motive way more complex than just evil demon wants power. She thinks it's destiny.
Right. It adds this whole other layer. And she boasts about its power. One hit kills.
Yikes. Okay. How does Wukong react to all this?
He just laughs. Coldly.
But the demon gets the last word for a moment. She hits him where it hurts, calls him Uzi Bimuan.
Oof. The stable boy title.
Yeah, the job he hated in heaven. The text says, Utu no Uto, those three words just infuriated him. It totally works.
Classic Wukong. His pride is still his weak spot, even facing a moon weapon. So, round two, the Dun versus the Boo, right there at the West Heaven Gate. Furious battle.
And the source points out the contrast again. This just sucks. One came down to marry, the other's there protecting Tang Monk. Different motives, equal power, it seems.
and it even mentions the king's love of flowers. It's as the thing that attracted the demon in the first place.
A little detail, but it shows how seemingly small things, simple desires, can kick off huge cosmic events, unintended consequences.
So who wins this round? Well, after maybe a dozen more rounds, the demon starts to fade. Her power wanes.
Okay.
She makes one last desperate escape, transforms into 10,000 rays of golden light, and zips off south into a mountain cave.
Does Wukong chase her right in?
No, actually. He's cautious now. He shows how he's grown, maybe. He decides to get the lay of the land, memorize the mountain's features.
Smart, tactical.
Yeah, then he heads back to the palace. He's worried the demon might sneak back to the kingdom and attack Tang Monk secretly.
The king of Tianzhu Kingdom, his consorts, they are terrified.
Here,
Utter.
yeah, imagine finding out your own daughter is, or
Yeah.
not your daughter,
Yeah.
an imposter.
The chaos must have been immense. And right then, as the king is begging Tang Sanzang for help, who shows up?
Sun Wukong, of course,
Yeah.
descending from the clouds. Very dramatic.
Always. But Tang Sanzang's reaction, it's interesting, isn't it? Not just go get him.
No, it's very insightful.
Yeah.
He tells Wukong, whoa, hang on, stop. Don't startle the king. He asks for the details first. This fake princess, tell me more.
Yeah.
It really highlights that core theme, you know. Amidst all the chaos, the need for force, there's still this underlying need for calm, careful inquiry to get to the truth.
Such a contrast to Wukong's usual style.
Right. His punch first, ask questions later approach.
So Wukong gives his report. Quick. To the point, the fake princess. A demon. They already fought it. But it turned into a breeze. And just zipped off towards the heavenly gate.
Yeah, a clear breeze. And heading towards the heavenly gates. That's a big clue right there.
He even had to call the heavenly gods to block it. What does that tell us about this demon's power, maybe, or where it came from?
That's a massive hint. Even if Wukong doesn't fully clock it yet. Fighting heavenly gods for, what, 10 odd rounds?
Yeah.
And then escaping his golden light. That screams celestial connection. This isn't your average earthbound monster.
Good point. It foreshadows what's coming later, that divine angle.
Definitely operating on higher plane.
So couldn't win, turns into golden light, escapes to a mountain down south. Wukong zips back, worried about his master, naturally.
And the king is just beside himself, grabbing Tang San Zhang. Where is my real daughter?
Totally understandable anguish. But Wukong, you know, full of confidence.
Oh, yeah. Swagger.
He reassures him. Look, once I catch the fake one, your real princess, she'll turn up. Naturally.
Which you can imagine is a huge relief to the queen and the consorts. They immediately promise rewards, heavy rewards.
But then Wukong gets tactical. He doesn't just charge off again.
No. This is where you see his strategic mind kick in. He tells the king and Tang San Zhang, go to the main hall. Queen and consorts, back to their quarters.
Right.
Summons his brothers, Pigsy and Sandy, tells them, guard the master. Nope. Why? He says it gives privacy, eases his own mind.
Aw.
But really, it lets him discern clearly and crucially set the stage to show his skill later. He wants a public resolution.
Ah, it's all about the reveal. Smart. Not just fighting, but managing the whole situation.
Exactly. It's stage management as much as demon fighting.
The king's totally on board, grateful, leads Tang San Zhang out. Pigsy and Sandy arrive quick, get their orders. Guard duty.
Diligently, Wukong insists.
And Wukong, off he goes. Somersault Cloud Express. The court officials are just bowing, totally impressed.
He doesn't waste a second. Straight to that southern mountain and finds the demon's hideout.
Turns out it fled into a, quote, nest. Block the entrance with stones.
Timidly hiding inside, the text says. Quite the turnaround from fighting heavenly gods, eh?
Yeah. But Wukong's patience wears thin fast, as we know. Can't find it immediately.
So he does the Wukong thing. Summons the locals. Earth god, mountain god. Time for an interrogation.
We've seen these guys before, haven't we? These minor local deities, often a bit bureaucratic,
yeah.
Maybe a bit clueless.
It's putting it mildly sometimes.
Right.
And yeah, that impression holds up here. They show up, bowing, apologizing for not knowing he was coming. Standard procedure.
Wukong warns them, no lying now. Demands the mountain's name, how many demons live here?
And their answer is just perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, this is Maoying Mountain. Just three rabbit holes here. No demons since ancient times.
Maybe look somewhere else on the road west. Like, they have absolutely no idea.
None whatsoever. It really underlines that recurring theme, doesn't it? These huge cosmic events are happening, and the local admin, completely unaware, highlights Wukong's league.
So Wukong has to spell it all out for them, the whole story. Tianzu Kingdom, the abducted princess left in the wilderness. The demon impersonating her, tricking the king, the colorful tower, throwing the ball to pick Tang San Zhang.
Right. Specifically to induce his primal yang. That detail's key.
It really is. What exactly does that signify here? It sounds serious.
Oh, it's deeply serious. It means the demon wanted to drain Tang San Zhang's pure life force, his spiritual essence. It's a demonic cultivation tactic, aiming for immortality or more power by consuming purity.
So, not just a marriage plot, an attack on his very being.
Precisely. A spiritual assault.
Wukong continues his story. Exposed it in the palace, it shed its disguise, fought him with that weird staff.
The medicine-pounding pestle. Another clue hiding in plain sight.
Fled as a breeze, chased it to West Heaven Gate, fought again.
Cannot rounds, yeah.
Couldn't win, fled as a golden light to this specific mountain. How, Wukong asks, can you not have seen it?
And suddenly the penny drops for the local gods. Hearing all the details, especially the pestle and the golden light, maybe?
They immediately lead him to those three rabbit holes. There are some actual grass rabbits lower down that scatter.
But right at the top, two big stones blocking a cave, and the earth god goes, ah, this must be it, where the demon frantically dug its way in.
Their aha moment, finally. So Wukong, no messing about, smashes the stones with his rod.
And whoosh, out leaps the demon, pestle ready, attacks Wukong.
Wukong blocks.
The poor mountain and earth gods are terrified. They just back off fast.
Understandable. The demon even curses them. You led him here. Fights defensively, retreats into the air as night starts to fall.
Wukong is furious now, absolutely livid. He's ready. Raises his rod for the killing blow.
The end of the line for the demon. Or so it seems.
But just then, that voice from the sky. Great sage, stop. Spare its life.
Boom. Divine intervention arrives. We shift gears completely here from a demon hunt to celestial court business.
Totally. This is a real deus ex machina, but with, like you said, that karmic twist. It's the Taiyin Jinjin.
The Lunar Star Lord herself, with Hengi, or Changi, and her fairies, descending on colorful clouds. Proper spectacle.
And Wukong, he knows authority when he sees it, instantly stops, bows, apologizes.
Respect for the celestial hierarchy.
The Star Lord then drops the bombshell, this demon, it's her jade rabbit, from the Moon Palace, Gwangun Palace, the one that pounds the elixir.
The Mystic Frost Elixir.
It escaped a year ago. And Taiyin Xingjun foresaw this life-threatening disaster for it, so she came personally to save it. Asks Wukong to spare it.
What of Wukong's reaction to that? He immediately puts two and two together, doesn't he?
He does. No wonder it used a pestle, so it's a jade rabbit.
Why is the pestle suddenly so significant to him now?
Because it connects the dots. That seemingly random weapon, the medicine-pounding pestle, clicks into place. Pounding elixir, jade rabbit, moon palace. It confirms the origin. Wukong's like a detective finding the crucial clue.
It shows how cleverly the story weaves these details in, doesn't it? Rewards you for paying attention.
Absolutely. Subtle foreshadowing.
But Wukong, you know, he's still the guardian of justice here. He doesn't just roll over. He protests.
Rightly so.
Lists the crimes. Kidnapped the princess. Impersonated her. Tried to break my master's primal yang. These aren't small things. Can't just be forgiven, he argues.
And this is where Taiyin Xingjun reveals the real story. The deeper truth. Yeah, the linchpin, as you called it. She explains the Tianzu princess. Not just any mortal. Originally, she was Suni from the Moon Palace.
Toad Palace, yeah. Another name for it.
And here's the twist. 18 years back, Suni S. slapped the jade rabbit.
A slap. Seems so minor in the grand scheme.
But apparently not. That slap, this tiny act, created a karmic debt that spiraled into this whole mess.
Cosmic payback. A celestial grudge playing out centuries later on Earth. Incredible.
Because of that slap, Suni felt this pull, longed for the mortal world, descended, and her spirit ended up reincarnated in the queen's womb, born as the princess.
So the jade rabbit held onto that grudge all this time.
Apparently so. Escaped the Moon Palace last year specifically to get revenge, abandoned Suni the princess in the wilderness, kicks off the whole impersonation plot.
Wow. Long game.
Taiyin Xingjun admits, okay, yeah, trying to marry Tang Senzang, that is unforgivable. But she points out, your vigilance, Wukong, prevented any real harm to your master. And she pleads, basically, forgive it for my sake.
And Wukong, seeing the bigger picture now, the karmic entanglement, he agrees.
He says he dare not defy because of the karma involved. Smart move, but he has a condition.
Yes. Always the strategist.
He requests Taiyin Xingjun and the fairies take the jade rabbit back to the king to prove everything publicly.
Brilliant. Why does he insist on that?
He says it will show my skill, yes, but also explain why Suni came down in the first place, allow the king to get his real daughter back, and fulfill a manifest retribution. It ties everything up neatly, publicly.
It's about closure. Not just solving the problem, but demonstrating the truth, validating the journey, completing that karmic cycle for everyone to see.
Exactly. Total clarity. Taiyin Xingjun agrees, points at the demon, commands it, return to your true form.
And poof. No, more like a roll. It rolls over, reveals its true rabbit shape.
And the description is amazing. So vivid. Missing lip and pointed teeth, long ears and sparse whiskers.
Body like jade white fur, hooves like flying.
Red eyes like rouge dots on snow. It really paints a picture, doesn't it? The celestial creature.
Lying down, a white pile of plain silk, stretched out, a white frame of silver threads. Evocative. You see, its nature, its role, pounding elixir.
Wukong is delighted, overjoyed, the text says. He guides them all on his cloud back towards the capital.
Taiyin Xingjun leads her fairies and the now revealed jade rabbit, heading for the big finale.
So the grand public reveal. It's dusk now. Moon's rising. They reach the city just as the watchtower drums are beating. End of the day.
Perfect timing again. The king and Tang Senzang. Still in the palace hall. Bigsy, Sandy, court officials all there, about to wrap things up.
And then the celestial light show appears.
Imagine it. a colorful cloud from the south, glowing bright as day over the city. The awe of the crowd must have been immense.
Yeah, seeing actual divine beings after all that fear and confusion.
Must have been mind-blowing.
And Sun Wukong, master of ceremonies, calls out loud, "Your Majesty, King of Tanzu, bring out the queen, bring out the consorts, look."
Making sure everyone sees.
Under this banner, the lunar star lord from the moon palace, these fairies, the moon maidens, and this jade rabbit, that was your fake princess, see its true form.
The ultimate mic drop, the truth revealed for all.
The king scrambles, calls everyone out, queen, consorts, maids, attendants, they all come out. And everyone, king, Tang San Zhang, officials, palace staff, they all bow down towards the sky. Gratitude.
And not just them, the whole city. Every house sets up incense, kowtows, praise. It's a moment of collective worship, divine proof.
But just as everything is perfectly solemn and reverent.
Oh no, here it comes.
Pigsy, of course. Overcome by, well, pigsiness. He leaps into the air, grabs a Farini Changshanzi.
I'm Gigsy.
And yells, "Sister, hey, we're old pals, let's have some fun."
You just can't take him anywhere, can you? Some things truly never change. Classic Pigsy.
It's almost comforting in its predictability, but Wukong is not having it.
Swift discipline incoming.
Grabs him instantly, slaps him twice, calls him a boorish Pigsy, chews him out for having lewd thoughts at a moment like this, in front of deities.
And Pigsy's excuse. Just as classic.
Ah, just having some idle fun, brushes it right off.
Unbelievable. But kind of funny in its own way. Breaks the tension.
With that slightly chaotic end note, Tian Xingzhen turns her banner, gathers her fairies and the rabbit.
And ascends back to the Moon Palace, leaving everyone on the ground to just process.
And Monkey King, well, he's done his bit.
Ever efficient. Make sure the imposter is gone for good. Threat neutralized.
So the king, he's reeling, naturally, the dangerous past, but his daughter...
He turns straight to Monkey King, doesn't he?
He does, and that relief just vanishes. He's anguished, asking, "My divine monkey, you caught the fake one, but where? Where is my true child?" Oh, heartbreaking. That human element just crashes back in.
Absolutely. Solving one problem just through a much deeper, much more personal crisis into sharp relief.
And this is where Monkey King just... Well, he drops the first massive bombshell, something that would totally flip the king's world upside down.
He looks the king right in the eye, essentially.
And says what?
He reveals, "Your Majesty, your true princess, she's not mortal, not at all."
Whoa.
She is the immortal maiden Su from the Moon Palace.
Oh my goodness, imagine hearing that. Your daughter is celestial.
Yeah.
What does that even do to your sense of reality as a mortal king?
It's world-shattering, right? Your whole understanding of your family, your lineage, just gone.
Yeah.
And Monkey King, he doesn't even pause there. He immediately links this celestial identity to why this whole mess happened in the first place.
Ah, the motive.
An old grudge. Turns out, 18 years back, this immortal maiden Su, the real princess, apparently struck the jade rabbit.
Struck her, like hit her. Seems so. Maybe a minor thing in the grand scheme of the heavens. But for that rabbit? Oh, it festered. Deep resentment.
18 years.
Yeah.
That's dedication to a grudge.
It really is. It's a powerful point, isn't it? Even among celestial beings, a small slight can balloon into this huge, destructive thing.
So this wasn't just some random act of mischief by the rabbit. This was planned revenge.
Calculated. The text says, just last year, after nursing this hatred for ages, the rabbit finally acted.
How?
It secretly opened something called the Jade Gate Golden Lock. Sounds important.
Definitely sounds like something you shouldn't be opening without permission. A celestial security door.
Pretty much. A barrier keeping Moon Palace resident, well, in the Moon Palace unless allowed out. The rabbit jimmied it open and escaped, descended to Earth.
Okay, so it gets to Earth.
Yeah.
Finds the real princess.
Seizes her, throws her out into the wilderness somewhere.
Just abandons her.
Yep. And then shapeshifts into her likeness, completely fooling the king and the court, everyone. For how long? A year.
Wow. That's cold. And cunning. All over being struck 18 years ago.
Incredible, right? And crucially, Monkey King knows all this because the Taiyin monarch herself told him just now when she came to collect the rabbit.
So this isn't speculation. This is divine testimony, straight from the source.
Irrefutable.
But okay, the king's just heard his daughter is a celestial being who was kidnapped and dumped in the wilderness by a vengeful rabbit because of an ancient grudge. That's a lot. How does Monkey offer any hope here?
He does, thankfully. Right away, he tells the king, "Don't worry, Your Majesty. She's safe."
Safe. after being thrown in the wilderness.
Well, safe now. He explains she's at the Jetavana Enafapindika Park Monastery.
Oh, the famous Buddhist site. Okay.
But, and this is another strange detail, she's apparently feigning madness.
Pretending to be mad. Why?
We'll get to that. But Monkey promises the king she'll be returned by dawn, a little bit of reassurance after a day of pure chaos.
And the court officials, they must be witnessing all this.
They're completely awestruck. They've just seen celestial beings, heard about divine plots. They're convinced these monks have incredible powers, knowing future and past.
So they back Monkey King up.
Immediately. They urge the king, trust them, their plan will work. It sets everything up for the next day, really.
Right. So, next morning, the king's probably feeling a bit more grounded now the imposter's gone.
Definitely invigorated. He calls court early, eager for more news, more details about his daughter.
And this is where another piece of the puzzle slots in, but from a different person entirely.
Exactly. It's not just Monkey King's intel. Tang Monk, the leader of the pilgrims, he steps forward. He has his own story to tell.
Ah, the master. What did he find?
Well, he explains how, just by chance or maybe destiny, their journey brought them to that very same monastery, the Jetavana Enafapindika Park, seeking shelter for the night.
Okay.
And while he was taking a walk in the old garden there, he heard something.
What?
A sound of just profound sobbing. Deep sorrow.
Coming from inside the monastery.
Seems so. And this is where it gets really interesting. The truth emerges bit by bit from different angles.
So Tang Monk investigates.
He asks about it, and an old monk there being over 100 years old.
Wow.
He hears Tang Monk's questions, tells everyone else to leave, and shares the secret he's been keeping.
The secret of the sobbing.
The secret of the princess. This old monk knows her story.
So what is her story from her perspective? How did she end up there?
Well, according to what she told the old monk, she was just enjoying a nice evening looking at the moon and flowers in the palace garden.
A perfectly normal princess activity.
Right. When suddenly this fierce wind just scoops her up, grabs her and whisks her away, depositing her right there at the monastery gates.
Just like that, like the Jade Rabbit story implied. Okay, so she's abducted and dropped off. What does the old monk do?
This is the really fascinating part, showing that unexpected kindness. The old monk, he's described as knowing human etiquette. He understands she's royalty, she's vulnerable.
So he helps her.
He does, but in a very strange way. He's worried about the other monks in the monastery, calls them bad monks or wansung, maybe undisciplined. He fears they might harm her or pollute her is the word used.
Okay, a genuine concern.
So to protect her, he locks her away in a secluded room, keeps her hidden.
Right, makes sense.
But to stop the other monks from getting curious or trying to bother her, he tells everyone she's a demon.
He tells them she's a demon to protect her.
Exactly. A compassionate deception. He figures if they think she's a dangerous demon locked away, they'll stay clear. It completely challenges your idea of what protection might look like, doesn't it?
That's incredibly clever.
Right.
And kind of sad. So he's basically labeled her monstrous to keep her safe.
Precisely. And the princess, she's smart. She understands what he's doing, why he's doing it.
So she plays along.
She does. This explains the feigning madness Monkey mentioned. During the day, if anyone comes near, she just babbles nonsense, asks for food, acts completely unhinged.
To keep up the demon act.
Right. But then at night, when she's alone, she weeps. Cries for her parents, her home. It's heartbreaking, but also shows her resilience.
Wow. Cooperating in her own confinement and mislabeling to survive.
Yeah.
And the old monk. What's he even doing all this time?
He didn't just lock her up and forget her. He kept trying to check what was happening back at the palace.
Okay.
But every time he checked, he saw the imposter princess, seemingly fine, living the royal life. So he didn't dare speak up. Who would believe him?
Yeah, confronting a seemingly healthy princess with a story about a secret mad demon princess hidden in a monastery. Tough sell.
Exactly. Until Tang Monk and his disciples arrived, the old monk recognized their holy aura, their supernatural powers, and knew they could finally reveal the truth and be believed.
He needed someone with credibility, essentially. Yeah. Divine credibility.
Yes. And Tang Monk adds one more chilling detail. He mentions his own encounter with the fake princess, the Jade Rabbit.
Well, yeah, you mentioned that earlier.
He realized who she was, and he says she actually tried to break his primal yang.
What does that mean exactly? It sounds serious.
It is. It refers to his vital essence, his spiritual purity. For a monk on a sacred journey like Tang Monk, it's core to his being, his path to enlightenment.
So it wasn't just a physical threat. It was a spiritual attack aimed at destroying his progress, his very essence.
Good grief. So the rabbit wasn't just impersonating. She was actively malevolent towards the pilgrims, too.
Definitely. So Tang Monk confirms it. The real princess is indeed at the monastery, still keeping up the madness act.
Okay, so now the king has the full story. The celestial identity, the grudge, the abduction, the old monk's crazy but kind clan, the princess's suffering and cleverness.
All of it. And hearing it all laid out like that, the king just breaks down, a profound cry of grief.
Understandable. All that time, his daughter was suffering, hidden away.
And his grief, it echoes. The text says it startled the three palaces and six courtyards. That's like the entire royal household, all the consorts, officials.
A whole palace is weeping with him.
It's a moment of shared sorrow. A kingdom mourning its lost princess, who is now, finally, about to be found.
So what's the next practical step? Does the king ask how far away she is?
He does. Maybe grief turning into urgent action. How far is this monastery?
And Tang Monk.
He replies, only 60 li, which, you know, isn't that far. Maybe 20 miles or so.
Definitely doable. Close enough to bring her back quickly.
Absolutely. A manageable distance for a royal retrieval mission.
And the king doesn't waste a second, does he?
Nope. He immediately issues a decree. He's going himself.
Taking the whole crew.
Pretty much. The empress, the grand tutor, a top official, lots of other court members, and of course, the four monks, Tang Monk and his disciples. They're all going together to bring the princess home.
A full royal procession. And Monkey King gets to the temple fast. Like, incredibly fast.
Right. The text says he doesn't walk or even really fly back in the usual way. He just does that trick.
The waist twist.
Yeah, twists his waist and just appears. Pops out of the sky.
Classic Monkey King. It's such a signature move, showing off his, you know, mastery of speed and transformation.
And the monks, they're just standing there completely stunned. Then he gives them the super quick explanation like, hey, the king and queen are on their way.
And just like that, their whole sense of time kind of shifts, doesn't it? Uh-huh. It sets the stage for what's coming.
He's really efficient, too, telling the old head monk what happened. No messing about.
No, it's like a bullet point summary.
Yeah.
Fig princess, embroidered ball trick. Tried to marry the boss. We chased her, fought her. Turns out she's the jade rabbit. Tie and star took her away. Boom.
Done. Tough. Concise.
But what's really interesting is the effect on the other monks. Because suddenly they realize, wait a minute. That girl we had locked in the back room.
Was the real princess.
Exactly. It clicks. This wasn't just some demon messing around.
Yeah.
It was a real human tragedy happening right there.
Yeah.
You can almost feel their perspective shift from, you know, fear to empathy.
That's a powerful moment. And then almost immediately, the procession arrives.
Yep, the king, the queen, even these four divine monks show up. Big arrival.
And the king sees Monkey King already there and is like, how'd you get here so fast?
And Monkey, he just kind of laughs off, right? He gives that classic understated reply.
Oh, just twisted my waist.
Yeah. But then comes the reunion. And this, I think, is maybe one of the most moving parts.
The king and queen seeing their daughter again.
It's so raw. The text uses the word broa, like filth or defilement, describing maybe what she endured.
Mm.
But they don't care. They just grab her, embrace her. All that royal protocol just melts away.
It's just pure parental love, isn't it? Unconditional.
Totally. It feels very human, very relatable, especially compared to how society might judge. And then they immediately start caring for her.
Right. Bathing, changing clothes, getting her ready to go back to the palace. It's practical, but also really compassionate.
Yeah. But then Monkey King does something. Well, unexpected.
Okay. Instead of just basking in the glory of the rescue.
Right. He immediately brings up a totally different problem. This
yeah.
place called Sawin, Hundred Leg Mountain.
Oh, yeah. The one infested with centipede spirits that attack travelers?
Exactly. And you'd think, okay, Monkey's going to go zap him with magic or bash him with his staff.
Where's his usual MO? Yeah.
But no.
Yeah.
His solution is different. It's almost like ecological.
Ecological.
So he suggests releasing Sawin 1,000 large roosters onto the mountain.
Roosters? Seriously?
Seriously. Because, you know, chickens eat centipedes. It's basic biology.
Huh. So instead of magic, he uses nature.
Pretty much. It shows him as more than just a fighter. He's a strategist, thinking outside his usual supernatural box. It's grounded wisdom, understanding natural balances.
Wow, that's actually a really cool insight. It kind of redefines what his power means.
It does, and it doesn't stop there. He also suggests to the king, hey, let's thank the monk who looked after the princess.
The old monk at the temple.
Yeah. He says, rename the mountain in his honor, give him an official commendation.
And the king's obviously overjoyed about his daughter, so he's all for it.
Totally agrees. So Hundred-Legged Mountain gets renamed Forf Precious Flower Mountain.
Nice. A much better name.
And the temple gets a makeover too, a grand new title. Say Ishi.
Which means?
Something like Imperially Built Precious Flower Mountain Yegu Bujin Temple. It emphasizes the royal connection and probably has some Buddhist significance too.
Okay, so the place gets honored. What about the monk himself?
He gets a permanent hereditary official title. The Nation Repaying Monk Official.
Hereditary. Wow.
Yeah. And a salary to go with 36 shucha grain every year. It's not just a quick thank you.
It's a legacy. It ties the place, the person, and this whole event together permanently.
Exactly. It transforms the landscape, literally and figuratively.
So after all this resolution and recognition, naturally, there's a celebration.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
A big feast back at the palace. Lasts for days.
And we know who loves a feast.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the text specifically mentions Pigsy is just having the time of his life devouring with all his might for like 5 or 6 days.
Figures. But even amidst all the celebration, they still have their goal, right?
The journey.
Right. And that leads to the next challenge, actually leaving.
The king wants to shower them with gifts.
Huge gifts. 200 ingots of gold and silver, plates of treasures for each of them, lavish stuff.
But they turn it all down.
Every single bit. It really hammers home their dedication, doesn't it? Their focus isn't on worldly rewards.
But they've got their eyes on the prize, the scriptures. But leaving is still awkward. The king, the queen, all the officials, even the monks from the newly renamed temple.
They all want to give them this huge formal send-off.
Exactly. It's this massive crowd. And the pilgrims can't just, you know, politely slip away. It's becoming a bit of a scene.
So Monkey King needs one more trick up his sleeve.
One final flourish. He conjures up a wind.
Not just any wind, right? The text calls it,
Yeah, but a blast of dark wind, or maybe obscuring wind from the southeast.
And what does it do?
It basically just temporarily blinds everyone in the farewell party. Kicks up dust, makes their eyes water. They can't see a thing for a moment.
Clever.
And in that moment of confusion, poof, the pilgrims are gone.
Vanished. A perfectly magical escape keeps their journey moving without fuss.
It's a neat, almost humorous way to wrap up their time there, keeping them untangled from worldly affairs.
So looking back at this single chapter, it's actually packed, isn't it?
It really is. You've got the resolution of the Jade Rabbit plotline, this surprising bit of practical ecological problem solving with the roosters.
The lasting recognition for the monk, changing the whole landscape's history.
And then that constant reminder of the pilgrim's commitment, refusing the gold, slipping away to continue their real mission.
It's a lot more than just moving the plot forward. There are layers about, well, duty, wisdom, human connection.
Definitely. And the chapter ends with this really beautiful resonant line. It ties back to that title we started with.
Oh, yeah. What is it?
It's Treensbul translation.
Roughly.
Bathed in the clean waves of grace, one returns to true nature. Exiting the golden sea, one comprehends emptiness.